Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on that zero emission future that we all hope for. And as always, I am joined by a wonderful member of the EV Cafe team. And this week, as often is the case, I've got the lovely John Curtis. Welcome, John.
I wouldn't miss it for the world, my friend.
Well, we've got the great privilege, as I mean, I'm always buzzed with these, but I'm particularly buzzed to talk to somebody that is really an innovator, a pioneer, and a collaborator in our wonderful fleet industry, a guy that has been doing this game for a little while now, and that is Duncan Webb from the AA. Welcome, Duncan.
Well, thank you very much. I hope I live up to that very grand introduction. Well, it's lovely to be here.
Duncan, you and I have known each other a while, and we've discovered in conversations early doors that John and you were in the same company for a while.
Yeah, we were at BT together. Duncan was very high flyer, and I was a very low flyer.
Fantastic. So I'm sure
it's harder to get shot lower down.
That's a nice way of looking at things. But Duncan, before we go too much further, because I mean you do have a very esteemed career in the fleet world. You've done a lot of really great fleet jobs, but I'm really curious as to how you got there. But I'm also curious, I mean, you've done a few bits in your time, but I love one of your early jobs, which was looking after 3,000 birds. And we're talking the feathered kind here because we are a forward-thinking, grown-up kind of podcast. We're not being...
titter. So 3,000 birds. There? See what I did there?
Yes, indeed. Yes, we do see. But you looked after the 3,000 chicks and made sure that we're happy at the weekend. Apparently, you don't have the same problem now. Not quite sure what that means. Maybe you could tell us what was the job and why don't you have that problem anymore?
Well, the job was like any teenager trying to earn a few quid. My mum used to work in a farm, and they branched out into free-range chickens. And the guy used to like his weekends, so he used to want to have somebody on a Saturday and Sunday go up and, love them, stroke them, collect 3,000 eggs a day, feed water and put them away so Mr. Foxy couldn't get in at nights. So, for about two years, that was my job. Come rain or shine in the cold weather. I actually used to sit in the hut with them in the cold weather because if you put so many birds together in such a tight area, it actually becomes very warm, believe it or not. And I used to sit there eating my sarnies in the middle of them. So yeah, for 2 years, I dread to think how many eggs. That was about 6,000 a weekend. So
probably
graded over 500,000 eggs in my very, very early career.
And Duncan, it's a strange set. I've done that. I've done that job too, funnily enough. And I remember going in and the nesting boxes where they go and lay their eggs. Sometimes you'll find a chicken still in there. And I used to go and tap on top of the box and they'd hop out. But one refused to move. And so I got a bit impatient, grabbed the chicken to take it out of the box. And as I did so, it laid its egg. As I launched it into the space, and the egg landed on the floor, and all the other chickens went loopy and all started to eat the egg. It was the most bizarre thing I've ever seen. Similar experiences at your end?
They certainly do eat their own eggs.
Yeah.
If there is one cracked in any way, they in a bizarre way, they do actually eat their own eggs. And probably not as direct an experience of that. I've got some other chicken related stories, so I don't think it's probably appropriate for the call.
Indeed. And, I just didn't know we'd gone into sort of nature, and you know, taken a different tour this podcast. It's my own fault.
So we've got BT and looking after
chickens,
chickens in common so far.
Well, let's keep going. Let's see what we've got.
I love the pun branched out into looking after birds, but you know, anyway, it was missed. But so, I mean, that's curious, because one of the other interesting facts is you almost made it as a professional footballer. And now I realise that the almost is that you didn't have time to practice on Saturday and Sunday because you were looking after 3,000 chickens.
Yeah, the good players got to play. I didn't.
So tell us about it, because I mean, it shows like a real aspiration to, you know, to be great, to be the best at something, to work hard. You're obviously working hard with the weekend job. Saturday and Sundays you were earning a few quid, and then you were trying to play football as well. So what was the engine room like in Duncan at the back then in those days?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always motivated by a hard challenge, and football for me, I was quite lucky. It came quite naturally to me. Mm-hmm. However, I went to one of these schools where they preferred to put you in the rugby team rather
quite
than
right.
the football team.
Quite right.
Okay. And if I'm being honest, I was probably built more for rugby than I was for football. So you sort of look back and go, yeah, quite rightly so as well. But football very much was my passion and still is. But unfortunately, your skill level only takes you so far. You know, you can be an athlete to a certain degree. And get a long way in different sports, but my skill level only took me so far. So yeah, at the age of 16, I didn't get signed up into professional terms, and I then actually left the chicken career and left the football career, and I didn't actually tell you this, but I went and started a Burger King career.
Started a Burger King career, or started a Burger King?
Started a Burger King career. Well, it was actually Wimpy, if everybody can remember back
oh,
that
yeah.
far.
Oh, yeah,
you
love Wimpy.
Remember? Yeah, Wimpy, yeah. And one of my other things I didn't call out was the fact that I used to dress up as Mr. Wimpy to drum up trade on a Saturday and Sunday between the ages of 16 to 18. So
it's fair to say that you didn't deal with the disappointment of not being signed for professional football very well. It just went off and flipped burgers.
Went off and flipped burgers and never looked back. Yeah, but I get quite driven by taking on a personal challenge. I know I called out. I went on the London Marathon again. I'm not built as an athlete to do the London Marathon. It took me. I know you was with James Starling not long ago, yes, on one of these podcasts, and he's the opposite. He is an athlete, an absolute athlete, and I'm not. But it took me about 6.5 hours to get around the London Marathon. But you know, it's the personal challenge that comes with that, you know, that thing you see in front of you to get over it and be successful.
Why is that, Duncan? What drives you in that way? I mean, was it as you were growing up? I mean, it sounds like you went to a good school. Was it the schooling? Was it your parents? Was it the environment that you were in? What gave you that engine room that was so driven?
I think it's actually me. You know, my parents were always really supportive, but didn't necessarily push me down a particular way or drive me into a certain thing. Very much let me found the thing that made Duncan happy and successful. But it's just always been in my way to, you know, succeed, whatever that might be, whether that be a short little project of success or a long run, big transformational change, you know. You only do the big stuff by breaking it down into little stuff and getting yourself along the way. So, and just keep challenging yourself to keep learning along the way.
And as Paul rightly says, Duncan, you're a fleet professional of the highest order. How does that come about? How did you get into fleets in the first place?
Yeah. Oddly, if I'm being honest. So, my very professional career, we said we was at BT together. I'm a finance bod by background. Yes. So
Chartered Institute of Accounting.
Professionally trained, qualified, and 6 months after that, I left finance teams and I've never been back.
You're too nice for that.
That qualification, it's not just about numbers. It teaches you how to run businesses, be good business people, returns on investments, and you know all of the good stuff that went there. And I ended up in BT in the corporate finance division, and we were going to sell our fleet business, what was called BT Fleet at the time. And we as a company, BT, wanted out. Cut a long story short, we didn't sell it back in 2002. I'd run a lot of the sales process. I went from knowing nothing about fleet to knowing pretty much everything about this company, fleet, how you run a fleet from cradle to grave, from all the way through. And the MD, BT, decided to keep it, and the MD of the business just turned around and said, right, I'm fed up with you on that side of the table. You're on my side of the table. Welcome to fleet. Off you go. Design the product portfolio, because that's when we took that business from being a one business customer to a multi-pool B2B strategy. Built the product strategy, implemented the product strategy, then took it to market. So sales and marketing director for 6 to 8 years, then commercial director for a further 6. And obviously ultimately got sold to being Revis. But yeah, fun days. It was one of those you look back on and go, I never thought I'd end up in fleet. But once you're in, yeah, you sort of don't get out. You love it. I absolutely love it. And so, yeah, fell into it by accident 20 years ago, but wouldn't change it for the world.
You say you love it, Duncan. What do you love about fleet? Because it's a darn challenge. You know, we meet fleet managers all the time, and they're always pulling their hair out and saying, you know, I've got this challenge, that challenge. I've got this person, that person. Won't drive this, can't drive that, downtime this. It's a tough gig. What is it that really makes you happy in the morning and think, yeah, I want to go and do that?
I think I'm really lucky in the job I do for the AA, because you can see it very much in real time that day, what happens on the ground, certainly in our roadside businesses. Okay. You know, if vehicles aren't around that morning, customers are not going to get served on the side of the road. The bit I like about it is I think a fleet manager needs such a broad level of skills. I really do. Is there's certain operational roles where you know it's more factory based, processes orientated. There's financial roles that are financial and the HR roles. I think a fleet manager role is quite unique, and there's almost a part of the business that it just does not affect or influence in any way. And your level of knowledge, level at the diversity of that, both a breadth and depth level, is really it's volumetric, and you can never stay on top of all of it. Okay. But there's very few careers I think out there that actually give you the ability to do exactly that, and go to work each day and go, well, this morning I'm dealing with a 300 vehicle order that I need to make, or a presentation to an FD, to Dave who's lost his car keys the next day, sort of stuff. It's genuinely rewarding, and I actually think the skills of a fleet manager are now even more vital.
Yeah.
You know, the whole, rewind 4 or 5 years, that the revolution of powertrains that we're going through now, it's just crazy. You know, we've all been used to, I'll get a diesel, I'll get a petrol, happy days, off we go. You know, the transformational skills required in a fleet role now is just outrageously huge. Okay.
Yeah.
Because you are changing not just the vehicle you use, you're changing the way your business looks.
Yeah.
And reacts, what the sales proposition might be.
And Duncan, I think your background has brought you to this spot, I think. You know, you were looking at the BT fleet. I hadn't realised that you were the person that basically took BT from an internal fleet to opening its doors and bringing in and becoming competition actually for, you know, for many of the other leasing companies and the other fleet management companies. You basically launched all of the things that you were doing internally to the greater public, and obviously then sold it on to Rivus, who have taken it on up until quite recently. And so I hadn't realized that, but it feels to me that that sort of level of change and proposition development and having to rethink perhaps a lot of what you've done has brought you to this role today in the AA. AA is a really exciting and interesting fleet. I know we've gone from the point of view that we can't really transition any of our fleet because we're towing most of the time, to considering all of the pockets of the fleet that you have there. Talk to me about the kind of diversity that you're now dealing with the AA, and how that transition is beginning, and where you see it going over the next sort of 3 to 6 months, 12 months, 24 months, that sort of time period.
Yeah, and it's probably worth just playing back what the AA's fleet actually is before I answer that, because everybody recognizes the yellow vans or the silver vans if you're a JLR or a VW customer, or the yellow trucks. You know, we have those heroes out there every day doing their thing. Okay, we've got over 8,000 vehicles, and the roadside fleet is only 3,000 of that. You know, we operate the largest driving school with 3,000 vehicles in driving school. We offer mobility solutions. So when we can't fix a customer at the roadside, a roadside customer, we give them onward travel and provide them vehicles in terms of onward travel and mobility until their vehicle is ready. So we do that for the JLR fleets, we do that for Porsche fleets. There's lots of others coming on stream at the moment. So all of that sits within Duncan's guise of, right, there's 8,000 vehicles, okay? So I break it down. There is never going to be a one-size-fits-all solution. Driving school, it's really demand-led, because obviously if you learn in an EV, you only get an automatic license. So therefore, you've got to balance that up in terms of the demand. About 3% of our driving school fleet is an EV now. So it's not huge, but we're getting there. Mm. In terms of our roadside fleet, we started on the vans, which is sort of the easier end, okay? We've got a product issue, Paul, and I think I've explained this to you before, in that no one would thank us to get into them at the roadside if we can't actually then do anything with them at the roadside. Yeah. Okay. The product to be able to tow with the electric battery weight has just not been available. We're starting to see it now with the right product coming into the market. Mm-hmm. You know, very practical things like we operate a tailgate back door rather than barn back doors, okay, for safety purposes, because you can imagine if you're on a motorway and you've got a barn back door that suddenly flies open. Mm. It's a real issue for all users of the road. Really pleased with our progress, though, on the truck front as well, which is going to be the hardest area to do for us, okay? We've actually got three electric derivatives of vehicle recoveries coming in just now. And that ranges from a traditional recovery truck, so 15-ton slide bed, through to 7.5-ton slide bed version. And we're also going down to electric crew cab derivatives that have what we call a CRT, compact recovery trailer, functionality on the back. So we're actually making strides across all of the components of the fleet in terms of changing its outlook. We've got one hydrogen vehicle as well in our roadside operation. That can only work within a certain space and geography just now. So we're trialing lots. I can't go mass adoption on roadside until product just gets us there.
Okay. And Duncan, what is that requirement there? I mean, you know, for all those manufacturers that are listening, if you want the AA fleet, what have they got to achieve in order to be able to be practical? And I understand the range and that's part of it. Towing, definitely, I understand. What sort of weight is a must? Because I guess you've got circa 2 tons on most of the transits that you need out there.
2.2 would be the 2.2. ideal. Right. If we could get something under 3.5 ton gross,
yeah,
low roof, tows 2.2 ton,
yeah,
and as a tailgate, bomb,
boom.
We'd buy, yeah. Sorry, it has to be low roof as well, because obviously we go into a lot of car parks to recover people.
Yeah,
we physically can't get in them. You know, it's a very practical thing, but you physically can't get in them if you have IVAN.
Yeah,
yeah. We found this a lot with the EV rally pool, didn't we? During the summer, the commercial vehicles that you're driving have a real problem getting into public car parks. It's a pain. Presumably, this is something that planning law needs to be updated to cope with, or is it just an inevitable that car parks will be car parks will be car parks, and they'll have low ceilings?
I guess we could both answer that, can we, Duncan? From my perspective, you know, like the multi-story car parks, obviously they've been built to a specification that allows X amount of space, and so therefore you have the very kind of practical issue of a concrete ceiling, which you know, you need to kind of be under. Out in the public domain, you know, all the more public car parks where there isn't a roof but there is a height barrier, it's typically to stop vans coming in. It's as simple as that. It's to stop vans or unwanted guests, and particularly there's a particular community that unfortunately will occasionally inhabit a car park for far longer than the usual hour or 2 hour ticket might permit, and they might not even bother to buy the ticket in the first place. So
where I was going with that was that, you know, the AA is an organization that not only does all of that breakdown stuff, and but there's the lobbying side to the work that you do. And, you know, Edmund particularly is particularly good at getting into politicians, and smart motorways is a good example of where he's had real traction in making change happen. And I wondered if, Duncan, sometimes you get frustrated with the reality that you're working with, you know, not being able to get into a car park is a pain in the backside for you.
I think there's certain things that happen like that. And you know, if I looked at our workload that's in front of us every day, quite a lot of our workload is tire-related workload to bring it to life. And the percentage of vehicles that now come without a spare wheel is... Mm. I think I've read a stat the other day, it was only something like 3% of new vehicles actually come with a spare wheel. So when we come and try and help you at the roadside, okay... That would have been quite, if you had a spare wheel, that would have been quite a quick fix for you as a customer, for us as a supplier. We now, it's one of our longest fixes because we have to put our spare wheel on, help you to wherever it is to get your tyre done, follow you to get our spare wheel back. You know, something that's as simple as that takes what is a relatively quick intervention for us and ties us up for a relatively short time into a very long intervention.
But it's been the mother of invention in that the spare wheel that you're talking about is something that can fit to pretty much any vehicle, irrespective of the number of bolts, lugs, whatever it might be that you call it. And the AA have developed that as a solution. It's just quite an incredible organization. The depth of things that you get involved with, it's remarkable.
From an engineering perspective, we've developed the you know, the freewheeling hub, and it can basically fit onto most vehicles with different plates and stuff inserted, and our guys and girls out there carry that as standard on there. Mm. And obviously, you mentioned Edmund and the team; they do a brilliant job on behalf of the UK motorist day in, day out. Edmund helps us, and we help him. In terms of, you know, simple stuff like the recent changes to regulations about we're allowed red lights now on the back of our roadside trucks on motorways. Mm. Okay. We've actually been fitting them in our truck, not in our trucks or in our vans. We've been fitting them for over a year, but we can't turn them on. Okay. But from a pure safety perspective of somebody attending on a motorway, materially different for our individuals come to help and the people in the incident and the other road users around. And that was a great change. Edmund's big on his potholes at the moment as well. But it's stuff like that. Potholes cause massive inconvenience, and we come and help to deliver. Yeah.
You're lifesavers, aren't you? It's not overstating the case to say the AA saves lives.
It does. It does. And there's actually some great stuff on some of our heroes, actually, if you just Google it or go on any social media site. There's some great stories of how our patrols do that day in, day out. It's not just about the vehicle. It's not the vehicle. It's the vehicle and the person. That's what we teach.
Yeah. It must give you a great sense of pride to be a part of this fleet at this particular time. Is there something sort of in the recent past that you are particularly proud of in terms of the team and something that stood out?
I've got to admit, I've only been at the AA for I think I might have clicked 8 months, and I know I got through my probation the other week. I got something from the HR system saying, "Yeah, okay, you're in." Yeah, you're too. I think, Paul, in the very recent time I've been there, what I see is a company that is very much engaged with what its purpose is as a company, and they've tried to sum that up into a very short statement of to create confidence for drivers now and for the future.
Nice.
And do you know what? It's just so true. Okay, everything we do, doesn't matter whether that's in the roadside business, driving school business, in some of those mobility solutions, even then taking it into my company cars or grey fleet management, we genuinely want to deliver confidence and want to do that now, but for the future as well. In my short time, we've done a lot and we've had to do a lot, but we've had to move away from one of our core suppliers was Revis. We've had to move away from them, and that was a partnership that's over 20 years long. Mm. Okay. Mm. And there's a reason companies work together for 20 years. Okay. Mm. And we moved away, to cut a long story short, but that means 300 of my colleagues, that's where they started work. It's where they contracted to start work. So it's not just about, oh, can I pick my truck up and, you know, get the next guy to look after it. It's where these guys start from. It's where they park. It's where we've recruited from, where they've grown, started to live around there. Mm. From a supply side, those people, you know them personally. You know the skills they have that they bring to your particular type of truck that you operate. Mm. They know the little nuances. You know, when they know when to push the right button and turn the right knob when you might not know to, sort of stuff. And we've had to do that in a really, really short window. And that doesn't get done by just getting a pen and going, yeah, I'll ring the next guy in the chain and they can do it. That's hard yards. And I'm really proud of the team that kept the business doing that and moving it and in keeping us everywhere in the country, because we work from about 50 locations, our trucks up and down there. So as a project for me to lead in my very early time in there, it sort of really brought home just how good the AA is at making those sort of big moves, complicated moves, but doing it well and still doing the day-to-day.
Mm.
And one of the things that you touched on, and you've done it a number of times, Duncan, is people, that we are very focused sometimes on the boxes of metal that go up and down the roads, or the boxes of metal that charge electricity or put out petrol or diesel or whatever it might be. But our business isn't about those boxes solely. It's about the people that make it work. And quite clearly, the AA have made you that they've helped you to appreciate the people that there are there who do keep those wheels turning every day. You must work with a team. What sort of team do you have within the AA? Is it a big team looking after 8,000 vehicles?
So we got, there's about 30 of us in total in my little bit of the jigsaw. That includes all of the teams, though, that run all the trucks out on the roads day to day. So we don't just look after the vehicle, we look after the person on the road within the vehicle. Okay, so I come back to it's not just the fleet role, you know, it's more than that. So if someone turns up and they haven't got a truck, Duncan just doesn't go, "Oh, sorry, you haven't got a truck." We've then got the person to go, "Right, we've got to do something with this person now to make sure that they get a good day's work out of them. They can still provide customer service." So, you know, quite a chunk of the team are in that space. So yeah, about 30 of it, 30 of us make that come together. But as ever, we're quite thin. We rely on brilliant partners in the supply chain to make this happen. Some of those partners are third-party partners. Some of them are our own AA teams. So AA's got an accident management business. So AA Accident Management do AA's accident management for us. Okay. So, you know, it's not just about my team. It's about the fact that I tap into to market partners, some of who are new because of, as I've explained around the Riva stuff, some of them who have worked with us for years to churn out new vehicles or give us in-life services.
So if I was joining your team, Duncan, and that would never happen in a million years because I don't know anything about fleets, but if I were to join your team, what do you stand for as a man, as a leader? Because clearly you're a leader of people. What are your values that are really key to making that team work well?
Straightforwardness.
Call a spade a spade.
With willingness to do it and do stuff that's put in the hard box. I'm trying to pick my word right here. Okay. I create an environment where I want people to lead themselves as well. And I've always sort of had this view, which is it's an honor to lead a team, but in actual fact, the best person to lead is the best person to lead. And if that's the most junior person in a circumstance, then that's fine. Okay. You know, it's very democratic in my world in terms of, you know, if someone's got better expertise, you know, I've been walking around most recently talking about DVS standards for London, the new safety standards down there. Okay. What does Duncan really know about that? Not a huge amount. Okay. But I've got a brilliant person who knows all about it. Okay. So they're my leader. They're my leader on that. You'll always get the space to learn as well. I was very, very lucky in my career to be taught how to be good at doing fleet stuff, okay? And therefore, I leave the space for people to find their way on that as well. I lead people, let people find their errors as well along the way. And I guess my final one would be get to know the people who work for you, all right? And you can't be brilliant at everything. So therefore, don't highlight their weakness. Embrace their strength. Okay, there's sometimes, you know, a turkey's a turkey at the end of the day. You don't want it to be a chicken, do you? So, you know, leave people to really bring their strength to the party. Okay, and maybe accept and acknowledge. Well, they're not going to be as good at that particular thing, but I'm not worried about that because in actual fact, I can live with that.
It's fantastic.
Speaking of turkeys, his poll.
Jeez, so rude. Oh dear. So where do I go? So I was going to make an important point because obviously I know that you have worked with another sort of well-known fleet manager, actually somebody that we've spoken to here, a lady by the name of Lorna McAteer, and I know that for a period of time you were her boss, weren't you? Is that right?
Taught her everything she knew.
Well, so it's your fault.
but this is the point, though, that I wanted to make. That, Duncan, you've clearly empowered somebody to be really good at what they did. And you helped them flourish and gave them, you know, some hints and tips and help along the way that enabled them to go on and do something great. So, you know, I think anybody working for you should take a lot of encouragement from that, because if you've just articulated those things that you want to bring the strengths to the fore and let them fly to carry on with the chicks and chickens and all that kind of stuff, although they're not well known for flying, but anyway, but it's what you do, isn't it? You help people be the best that they can.
It is, Paul, and I'm in the age bracket now where I want to pass on rather than take. I'm very much in the pass on. Lorna was always going to fly, by the way.
Okay. Yeah.
And I was blessed to have her for the time I did when I was at Royal Mail. She was obviously going to be destined for great things. So she taught me as much as I taught her, without a doubt. I feel very, very lucky to be in a position where if people are willing to take the time and the space to, you know, listen, then I'm willing to occupy that space to bring them on. Okay. I can be a bit nasty every now and then, Paul, as well, just to balance it all up.
Oh, okay. I don't believe you. You're a big softy. But Duncan, so listen, you've got a great group of people around you, people being the best that they can be. There are really critical challenges right now. We're looking, the whole of fleet is in transition. We're doing a lot of learning, and in learning comes mistakes. In learning comes failure. In learning, there is difficulty as we go. What are the challenges that you're seeing? How are your team meeting those challenges? And what do you think is going to, where do you think the breakthrough is going to come for this next? Because vans are struggling, we know that. Commercial vehicles are hard. What is it that you think is going to be? Is there a silver bullet? Could there be a silver bullet? What's going to be the breakthrough?
I'm not sure on the silver bullet. You always hope that there might be some sort of astounding product breakthrough that gives you the silver bullet. But I think it is only ever incremental, and sometimes that incremental will be a little bit more than just a regular one. Where I see new challenges coming in is, let me just go off electric vehicles for the moment, but more into, I think we're working in a very, very different marketplace after all of the COVID cycle of stuff. I think the whole fleet automotive sector is a very, very different marketplace, from supply side dynamics to in life dynamics. And I think there is a real crunch on maintaining, keeping vehicles on road in this country. Mm. And I think that's a real squeeze area that's just going to become a problem statement over, well, it's a problem statement now. And I just don't think it's going to resolve itself. I think it's just going to be a far tighter market. So I sort of go, anything from an innovation perspective that can keep my fleet on the road, absolutely, okay, and getting predictive capability out of these brilliant machines that are computers flying around with a few wheels underneath them, okay, getting predictive capability out of what might happen with this vehicle rather than you wait until something has happened with this vehicle is something I know the market needs to embrace. We're working on the AA, okay, just now, to have predictive capability that really does help vehicle health. On the EV agenda, in my head, cars are sort of on their way. It feels like that's on its way. I'm a bit worried about the secondary market that is established or not off the back of it, but I think the primary market is well on its way. Then on vans, I'm not quite sure what would work out. The only tech I think could really work is a hydrogen combustion engine, okay? Because I think for vans, what you have just now is it works for certain market sectors. So what I think you're really seeing is people who don't have to go a huge distance, okay, have depot-based structures maybe where you can go back to rather than reliant on home in architecture, are sort of winning through. So, you know, you look at a lot of the logistics companies, they're doing a really great job on their van transition. Home transition, you can only take so far, you know, 30-40% maybe. So I think we need a breakthrough for an EV van that can, without question, do 200 mile. Okay. And I think if that milestone can be achieved, then I sort of go the barriers to adoption fall down. The other one is recharge speeds, Paul. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, you look at it now, the vans don't recharge very quickly compared to some of the car tech that's coming out just now. You know, so that's a real cost. I'd love a van to recharge at 200 kilowatts an hour on a rapid charger, but the reality is that they're not. So in the truck area, I'm actually really quite enthusiastic about the truck area. I know the supply side's moved around in the last 6-12 months in particular. It just shows probably how hard it is. But I actually think batteries, you know, if you have to drag 2 ton of batteries around behind you, it doesn't make a lot of difference. Most trucks don't run up to full weight anyway. Hydrogen injection come through? Yeah. Pretty sure it will. So I'm probably more optimistic about trucks, if I'm being honest. But that's where, let me just sort of talk about how that works for the AA. So if I look at one of my trucks today, all right, like I say, we're gonna get a 15 ton recovery truck in about four months' time on a Volvo product. I think our roadside recovery trucks stop for about 4 hours a day, overnight. That's it. So I've got a 4 hour window to take it from empty to full. Okay. Which means I probably need plugged in doing 120 kilowatt for 4 hours constantly to make sure it can just do the next day. That will just about do it, that vehicle. So I'm really pleased that the market's already showing it can launch a product that can fit my operating mode and recharge within a relatively quick time. But there is no one silver bullet on this. I think we just have to keep going and trying. Fail. I know we've failed on a few things in the AA in terms of vehicles we've got.
I think it feels to me, and I'm 100% with you on a lot of what you said in terms of like keep trying, because I think what we've done oftentimes is we've tried and we've failed and we've decided it won't work. And I think it's that continual learning and continually looking for, because technology and innovation is coming at us at such a pace. No, none of us really thought, and I think to your point really, Duncan, none of us really thought that trucks would be where they are. Now, whether, you know, with the battery side of things, with the speed of charging, with the infrastructure now sort of coming through in you know, dedicated mindset towards trucks, it is really, really impressive. But I am seeing also a little bit of progress with regards to charging speeds in vans in general. We know that this next batch of Stellantis are going to come out with 150 kilowatts charging speeds. We expect Ford to go up north of 125, I think, with the Transit E-Custom. And obviously we've got in the ID Buzz 170, you know, in terms of speeds. Now, but we've got this curve as well, which is a bit of a pest, really. You know, it doesn't really help us. And then you need the charging infrastructure to be able to deliver it. But there's a lot of stuff going on. And I'm with you. I'm surprised and encouraged by the development in trucks, and just hope that we can see that same innovation coming into vans, but not give up hope in the meantime.
No, absolutely not. I mean, one of the things I see in the truck space is maybe HVO fuel can just bridge the gap for a short window.
Yeah.
It's not, it's not the end game. It's not the end game. It's not the end game answer, but it might might bridge a few years for a lot of companies.
I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? We've got to do stuff today that can impact immediately whilst we are waiting for the longer term solutions, that the silver bullets, or we're often describing it as buckshot these days, because it's lots of little bits that will ultimately make up the thing that will do the damage in the future. But
indeed.
So, I mean, it's been an impressive, not only an impressive CV, but an impressive role that you've been taking within the AA, and obviously leading this organisation through what is going to be an incredible period of transition. It's been really helpful to get an insight into that. If you could kind of do one thing, wave a magic wand, what is it that you would do that would it be a government thing? Would it be a mindset thing? Would it be vehicles? What would it be that would make that difference for you? What one thing, one only?
I'm going to go bold and I'm going to go back to people, okay? If I could do one thing, I would get great young people to become fleet managers, and everybody, you know, make every company have somebody dedicated to do it, and somebody who grows up with that, you know, the technology, the way it is, the world, the way it is, the outlook of the world, the way it is, because it's almost, you would know from the industry, how if you looked around the industry and looked at age profiles and of people in it, it's people like me. It's
and
people
me,
like us.
And John. Okay.
And you know what? We're in the biggest transformation ever, okay? Mm. It's not that sort of job anymore. What you need is that next generation to say, look, do you know what, I want to be a fleet manager, and companies actually to go, do you know what, I want that person to be my fleet manager, because they're the ones who are going to lead me into that. So, yeah, if I have my one wish, is that every company would, you know, make a brilliant. Recruit a brilliant, young, technologically savvy fleet manager.
Love it. John?
I just think Duncan's got a great kind of clarity of thought. And I love the way that you actually stop and consider every question that you're asked. There's no knee-jerk reaction with you. It's all carefully considered. I suppose maybe that's the accountancy background. But you are somebody who I instinctively would trust to reach the right conclusion, because we do a lot of these podcasts, we do a lot of talking to people and live events and so on, and people almost feel under pressure to give the first answer that comes into their head. And twice today I've seen you stop, and there's almost that tumbleweed moment, which is awkward silence, and then bang, you've got it, and you give a considered response. And I think that's what we need. You know, Paul and I are a bit excitable, and sometimes we reach conclusions very rapidly, which may be flawed. But I think, Duncan, I'm encouraged massively to see that there are very capable, experienced senior leaders in this industry who are saying things which chime, you know, getting young people into this industry. It's all about the people, the drivers who are by the roadside. It's not about the boxes. That's a technical challenge, and your guys are better than anybody else to deal with that. But how you care about the people, whether you lead them, whether you interact with them as customers, you are an enormous role model for our industry. And it's been a real privilege to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
And
could say I'm just not very clever and I need a bit of space to answer the questions.
You know, I'm not very clever, but I just make lots of noise until somebody gets fed up and moves on. I think actually you underplay yourself massively, my friend.
Thank you.
Indeed. And Duncan, having known you for some time, and not, I won't say I've followed your career, but you've always been one of those people within the industry that people acknowledge as having wisdom around fleet and are bringing some a game that will make a difference for fleets, which is why you've done some of the biggest jobs in the industry. And I think with the AA fleet, with the diversification of it, with the challenge that they have, you're absolutely the right man for the job because of your desire to kind of put the fleet umbrella on, but then allow all of these new strands that are coming from this transition to be brought to life by people that are experts, or their strengths are in the right place to meet the need for the organization, for your own team. And I mean, one of the most exciting moments for me at the London EV show, which of course the AA did come and share the stand with us at the EV Cafe Village, but there was a company called Chargy, and they brought 7 graduates and thrust them in front of me and said, "Paul, tell them about the EV Cafe, and tell them about the industry, and tell them about vans." So, I mean, they had me at vans, right? But I was so buzzed by that injection of energy and those keen minds. And they were all nodding and hungry, obviously naive because they were listening to me, but it was exciting. And I think you've hit upon something really, really powerful, and I hope that people hear that wish and allow it to come to life for you. You know, to see these young people coming into businesses with energy and passion and drive and insight and savvy, and a hunger to actually make this sustainability thing, this transition thing, to happen, because actually they want to be around for a few more years and not see the planet melt alongside of them. So, Duncan, listen, thank you so much for today. Really insightful. Feel free if you've got any last thoughts, but to leave us with. But,
no, just thank. No, not at all. Just thank you to both of you. You do a brilliant job along with the rest of the EV Cafe crew. So keep it going.
Don't worry about the rest of them, but John and I'll take that. Yeah.
He's right, of course.
You are nice, really, you three. It's okay. Anyway, right, moving on. Duncan, thank you so much, and thank you to the AA too for being a great partner of the EV Cafe over the last few years, and we look forward to working with you guys obviously a lot in the future. Duncan, you're a mine of wisdom and knowledge, and we really appreciate your openness and the time that you've taken today on a Friday afternoon. Just for those of you, you won't know it's Friday afternoon, but it was Friday afternoon, just before we all knock off, or Duncan has to take another call from somebody else that's lost their keys. Anyway. So thank you, Duncan, thank you the AA. John, thank you for your company, been wonderful as always. And everybody, listen, if you want to hear more podcasts just like this, head over to the website evcafe.org and then /content, or just hit the content drop down box and you'll see all of our podcasts there. Many insightful and wise people just like Duncan, and innovators, pioneers and collaborators. We are so lucky as the guys that get to talk to these people. And hopefully you're lucky enough to listen to a few of these great people too. So thanks for listening, and have a great day, everybody.